This is Taking AIM, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking AIM starts right now.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to another scintillating episode of your favorite Saturday morning radio program here in the Sandhills. I'm Steve Woodward. Alongside me is David Hensley. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, everyone.
It has been a month worth of news and developments crammed into 1 week in the week that has just passed. And boy, do we have no shortage of stuff to drill down on, and we will begin doing that immediately, as we are once again taking AIM. We always kick off our programming with a identification of public enemy number one. And this week there were actually a lot of candidates, because there's a lot of stuck on stupid going on out there, especially in the realm of the highest profile people, members of the media and members of Congress. It's interesting how that works. But we have selected our public enemy number one, and he is none other than CNN's Jake Tapper. What a pathetic excuse for a journalist. I hesitate to use the word. But, you know, Jake decided...
Well, that's what I call them, urinalists.
Yes.
Urinalists.
Well, they're just nothing more than actors in a TV show. That's, unfortunately, they're very well paid to do that. But Jake and another fake journalist decided to team up and publish a book, which I'm sure Jake spent all of maybe 10 minutes participating in the actual drafting of. But they published the book entitled Original Sin, which the title in and of itself we could do half a show talking about the absurdity of. The book was just released, and of course, it purports to explain how all of these highly paid, very earnest journalists managed to overlook what everybody else, including you and I, could easily detect, which was the decline of then-President Joe Biden, the 46th president of the United States, but really fulfilling the third term of Barack H. Obama. And, of course, we saw this almost from the get-go, right out of the blocks when he was inaugurated in 21, and then the decline proceeded from there. We saw the stumbling up and downstairs. He's one of the few people who can fall up the stairs and did it quite well.
Well, him and Bruce Springsteen, it seems to be a trait among leftists that they fall up. Well, I mean, that's what leftists do, is they fell upwards. I mean, look at Kamala. She fell up. That's what all leftists liberals do. They fell upward.
That's a very good point you make. I hadn't thought of it that way.
I said it like three times.
Yeah, but anyway. It's very good. Yeah. But he and his co-author write the book, and now they're going out and doing what you have to do when you write a book, which is you have to go out and do the interview circuit to try to sell the book. I'll be very interested to see how this book actually performs when all is said and done on the shelves and on the websites. But
well, especially since there's not USAID money where some NGO could buy a million copies
right,
and throw it away and then go, look, it's on the number one bestseller right list. So I guarantee you that in the past, our taxpayer money was buying those books to A, enrich these leftists, and B, you know, it was a money laundering scheme, and then it made them look like people were actually reading their stuff.
I would not doubt it for one moment. So Tapper is so self-confident, apparently, so sure that he is doing the Lord's work by writing this book, co-authoring this book, he agrees to an interview with none other than Megyn Kelly.
Yeah, that's kind of a head-scratcher. I mean, do you think he thought he was going to get a pass, or do you think he was just that self-assured?
Now, Megyn Kelly, you know, is a story unto herself. She was, you know, once upon a time a Fox News you know, personality with a show in prime time, and then I think she left and went to NBC on some big contractual opportunity, and that completely imploded.
Yes,
in short order.
Yes.
And so she
thought she was going to go mainstream. She really kind of, remember, she attacked Trump, and then she kind of thought she could go. When she attacked Trump, everyone on the left applauded her, and she saw these dollar signs. I'm going to go for the legacy media. She swung and for the bleachers, and she missed.
Totally. So then she's left to her own devices to become a podcaster. Yep. Well, to her credit, she has become one of the top-rated podcasters.
And a strong conservative voice. Very strong conservative voice.
She is articulate. She's smart. She's a an attorney by through education, not practicing, of course. And so Jake Tapper walks into this hornet's nest with his, I guess, the co-author, and it got kind of ugly in a hurry. Play clip one.
Let's go right to the controversy around the book, and then we'll get to the contents of the book, which I definitely want to spend time on. As you know, this book, it's right in the subtitle. It involves coverage of the so-called cover-up. But Jake, the criticism has been that you're complaining about a cover-up about Joe Biden's mental acuity that failed, that right-wing pundits saw, the right-wing in general saw, that independent media saw and reported on, and that was no mystery even to left-wing and so-called mainstream reporters who were not fooled but chose willful blindness instead of honest reporting, and that you were part of it. How do you respond?
It's a tough and fair question. I would say that Alex and I, after Election Day, interviewed more than 200 people, mostly Democratic insiders, and almost all of these interviews were after the election. And they justified to themselves what they had done in terms of misrepresenting how the president was, not just to me and Alex and other reporters, but also just to each other and to the world and to Democrats and to the cabinet, et cetera, by saying that there was this existential threat of Donald Trump. And only Joe Biden could beat Donald Trump, and that justified everything in their minds. After that existential threat was over, because the election was over and Donald Trump won, we found, Alex and myself, remarkably willing to talk to us either off the record or on background, or in some cases on the record, about what they saw.
But the folly of that whole exercise, I mean, congratulations for interviewing 200 people, you know, all of whom are now interested in damage control for themselves, not for the party or for the Biden legacy, that's for sure. But the folly of the whole thing was that the book was being written in real time. We all saw it. And it wasn't just the fact that the guy was trying to run for re-election, thinking that only he could defeat the evil Donald Trump, but he was the president of the United States. He was presiding over this terrible open border policy. He was presiding over the recovery from the COVID economy, which, with inflation remaining persistently high, he was presiding over declining American strength being projected around the world, which is to say it was not being projected.
Well, as Obama said, managing America's decline. You remember that?
Yes.
Obama said we must manage America's decline. So, look, that one clip that we just played, that our Snerdly, our excellent engineer, played for us, it illustrates three things about leftists, right? First of all, that guy clearly has, I've never seen what he looks like, but he's got that liberal elitist voice. You know, that smirkly.
No, it's the Hamptons cocktail party
right.
voice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Boarding school voice.
Right. Yeah. But more importantly, moving beyond the ad hominem attacks that I had to get in. Look, this illustrates two additional things. One, besides their swarmy voice. One is all liberals ask you to suspend reality. Liberals, I mean, we all saw it. Liberals ask you you have to ignore what you see with your own eyes and hear with your own ears to believe what liberals are saying. And that's what they did here, right? Everyone could see. I mean, he would like shake hands with non-imaginary people. He'd like stop in mid-sentence and wander off into the woods in Yellowstone or whatever. I mean, everyone saw it. And these leftist media would ask us to suspend what we saw with our own eyes and believe that he's a spry, young, intellectually there. Everyone knew it wasn't true. true. But the other thing that was in there subtly is, if you listen, they all believe, the left always believes, that the end justifies the means. There was an existential threat that the voters might actually, like, be pro-America and vote for this, like, nationalist, pro-American Donald Trump, who's going to destroy all of our, all this liberalism and excess, right?
Right.
So liberals always want you to suspend what you see with your own eyes and hear with your own ears. And they truly believe that the end justifies the means. Their job is not to manipulate the news or cover stuff up. Their job is to report the news.
Well, yes. Wouldn't that be nice? But we really haven't seen that for decades, really,
right.
I'm afraid.
Yeah, certainly not out of the legacy media.
The carnage for Mr. Tapper only continued to escalate. Play clip two.
The comments of Joe Biden making gaffes, saying things stupid, tripping, are all important and all deserved to be aired and all deserve scrutiny. But as you know, Megan, because even though you look 30 years younger than me, we're roughly the same age, Joe Biden has been saying stupid things for decades. Okay,
I get and what you're saying, been, but this been, minimizes it too, because it was
no,
more
I'm
than
not
saying stupid things. But I'm telling you, like, over here in my ecosphere, we were covering all of these. It wasn't just falling down. It was getting lost. It was some of the stuff you report in your book, we knew and we were reporting on, like the multi-jump cuts in the videos of him, where it was obvious he couldn't get through a 1 minute take, so they had to use those. It was clear to us that he was using teleprompter, and there was some reporting on that at the time, all of which the White House was denying. Now, with the current White House, I have some connections. With the Joe Biden White House, I had none, but you did. You did. And so while you've been in Washington 30 years, Jake, you guys, you and CNN have White House connections, but there was no effort, none, to get to the bottom of this. And now
that's
for you guys to
accurate.
Write this book, like, there was a cover-up. It's like, you, there was a cover-up and there was an attempted cover-up. It could only ever work if you allowed it, if the press allowed it. Some of us tried not to, and some of us were complicit.
Very well said. How, you know, the cover-up was not coming out of the White House. It was originating within the various news organizations, which, again, using that term is... We need to come up with better phrases than news organizations, but they're, you know, they're agenda machines. They are appendages of the left, starting right, you know, from senior management right on down to field reporters and producers, and that really nails the whole essence of the Biden legacy. It is going to be a dark and bitter legacy, and you know, we'll get into this later on in the show today. The legacy continues to play itself out, the dark, disgusting legacy of the Biden administration, in terms of the fact that there are still plenty of illegal immigrants roaming our homeland with evil intent, and in some cases fulfilling those intents, and we'll talk about that later. But furthermore, the legacy of the COVID era is now coming to the fore. We're seeing now that more and more studies coming forward showing how these jabs, especially in children, are harming autoimmunity and causing other unintended health consequences. All of this was rammed down our throat in 2021, 22, and even in some cases into 23, because we had a feckless person in the White House and we had a complicit media which was more than happy to carry his water all day long. One of those equally feckless human beings is a member of Congress. We've talked about him, unfortunately, a lot lately. Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, a smug Democrat, if there ever was one, he continues to accuse the Trump administration and the Republican-controlled House of being inhumane in our quest to remove as many illegal immigrants from our country as we possibly can, because they should never have been here, and the longer they are here, they pose a danger. They're a drain on our health care systems, on our public education systems, so many things that we could go on forever talking about them. but they're all real problems. And of course, it was Van Hollen who made a beeline several weeks ago down to El Salvador to meet with this Maryland man, they called him, who had been deported along with a bunch of really bad guys to this jail. It turns out that maybe the jail wasn't the proper destination for him. However, being returned from where he had come from was certainly still a legitimate move by the Trump administration. Van Hollen goes down to El Salvador to meet with this guy and do a photo op and a sit down, and they had their, you know, their refreshments, and he was looking into his eyes like some kind of a love-struck, you know,
gazing lovingly into the terrorist eyes. Yeah. Into the criminal eyes.
Yes, into the eyes of Mr. MS-13 gang member and human trafficker. And then finally he came home, and that's sort of the dust kind of settled on that. But now they have made the mistake, sort of like inviting Megyn Kelly to interview you. This congressional committee brought in Secretary of State Marco Rubio, former senator from Florida, to
Little Marco,
formerly Little Marco. Now he's starting to cast a rather
large shadow,
formidable figure. Yes.
Yes.
He goes into this committee, and Van Hollen wants to take him on about deportation and how, you know, the Trump administration is willfully, breaking the restrictions that have been placed on it by these activist judges in terms of who and when they can deport people. And of course, Rubio took one look at Van Hollen and his smugness and couldn't help but have a special moment. This is a slightly elongated clip, but worth every moment. Please play clip 3.
And I have to tell you directly and personally that I regret voting for you for Secretary of State. I yield back.
May I respond?
You may, sir.
Well, first of all, your regret for voting for me confirms I'm doing a good job based on what I know.
Well, that's just a flippant statement, Mr. Secretary.
Can I respond, Mr. Chairman?
You
Mr.
may.
I didn't ask.
Senator,
questions.
Please let the Secretary
I'd
have
be
the
happy
floor.
To, but then I can respond to his.
Your
response.
Time's up, Senator, and woefully used, I might add.
Well,
your remarks do not represent the view of this committee.
Well, Mr.
Secretary,
Chairman,
please.
Well, I'd like to. I can't respond to everything he said because much of these are untrue, but I'll go through a few. First of all, I'm actually very proud of the work we've done with USAID. For example, I don't regret cutting $10 million for male circumcisions in Mozambique. I don't know how that makes us stronger and more prosperous as a nation.
I
don't regret
Sudan,
psychosocial Secretary. Support services.
I raised Sudan, Mr. Secretary.
Can I respond,
not
Senator? Senator, I'd ask you
can
to
that guy stop
you
talking?
You had 7 straight minutes.
I chose to use my time that way, Mr. Chairman. That's my right to
please
use
suspend,
my time that way.
Secretary Rubio.
Well, I can go on. I mean, there's other things here. We spent $227,000 for Big Cat's YouTube channel from USAID. We spent $14 million for social cohesion in Mali, whatever the hell
that's
means.
That's important.
So I can go on and on. I got the list here, and there's more. I didn't even bring the whole list. In the case of El Salvador, absolutely. Absolutely. We deported gang members. Gang members, including the one you had a margarita with. And that guy is a human trafficker, and that guy is a gangbanger, and the evidence is going to be clear. In the days to come, you're
Chairman,
going to see who you went to
look, defend.
Senator,
I'm sorry,
please,
Mr.
Secretary
Chairman.
Secretary Rubio has the floor.
Mr. Chairman, he can't make unsubstantiated
Senator,
comments like that.
Secretary Rubio has the floor. You
Secretary
had your
Rubio
time.
Secretary Rubio should take that they testimony to the federal
Senator,
of the United States because
well,
he hasn't done it under oath.
Sergeant-at-Arms, remove
okay?
this man.
There is a division in our government between the federal branch and the judicial branch. No judge in the judicial branch cannot tell me or the president how to conduct foreign policy. No judge can tell me how I have to outreach to a foreign partner or what I need to say to them. And if I do reach to that foreign partner and talk to them, I am under no obligation to share that with the judiciary branch. Just like a judge cannot order me to negotiate with a foreign minister of Russia, they cannot order me to negotiate with a foreign minister or the president of El Salvador. And if I did negotiate with them, which we have responded to them, and we've told them, we've had communications with the president of El Salvador. I am under no obligation, under our division of powers in this country, and to share with the judicial branch how I conducted diplomacy of the United States. It would actually be counterproductive. If I started sharing with courts, or frankly, with the media, my conversations with foreign leaders and all of their details, no foreign leader would talk to me again, and we would break trust with them. So I have complied with every court order. What I won't comply with is an order to disclose what I'm saying and what we're talking about with a foreign leader, because then they won't talk to me. Diplomacy doesn't work that way.
Gee, It's a shame that the Secretary of State had to explain that to a sitting member of Congress.
That sniveling little interrupting senator.
Congressman, yeah. Thank God he's not a senator.
Why do they keep calling him senator?
He is a senator?
I guess who can keep up with those knuckleheads? But look, here's the news out of Rubio is what a surprise he's been. You know, when he was nominated Secretary of State, I mean, we were all excited about Hegseth and all these other nominees. We're like, Rubio, okay, yeah, you know, okay, what, you know what? He's bilingual. He speaks Spanish. Their first mission is to go down and get the Panama Canal for us, which he did, by the way. We now, American companies now own all the ports along the and operate the Panama Canal, where the day before Trump got elected, Chinese companies own those.
100%.
But anyway, Rubio's been quite the surprise. And you know what? I heard some talking heads talking over the weekend on Breitbart News, and it was their executive editor, the guy who used to do their morning show. And I hadn't thought of this, but they were talking about presidential material and how if Rubio's top of the ticket in 2020, I mean, look, we all love Vance. We all love Vance. But their point was Rubio is such a surprise. And right now, if the way things are right now, if he was running for president, he would carry 48 states. Because he is loved across, I mean, he unanimously confirmed, right, I believe, in the Senate. He's attractive across a wide spectrum of people. And, you know, he has not disappointed so far in his role as Secretary of State.
I would say he has overperformed and really, and I mean, look at his commanding presence as he's going, you know, all over the world. He's in Saudi Arabia, you know, trying to negotiate a peace between Ukraine and Russia, or he's negotiating, you know, on the Israeli Hamas front.
Gonna bring Syria into the Abraham Accords. If Syria joins the Abraham Accords, Iran is done. The Houthis are going to get defeated. Hamas is out of Gaza, and if Syria joins the Abraham Accords, Iran stands alone with like North Korea, and that's it.
And that would be the desired outcome. No question about it.
And then, of course, failed African states, which are, you know, like most of them.
Well, speaking of African states, today is Saturday. Earlier in the week.
Yes. Easy to lose track of time.
It's a whirlwind. My head is spinning on its swivel every day of the week. The president invited to the White House earlier this week the president of South Africa. His name, I believe, is his first name is Cyril. The last name is not important. He was invited to the White House with the usual pomp and circumstances, greeted by Trump there in that side portico. And welcomed in with a slap on the back and the whole nine yards. And then they go into the Oval Office. And as is Trump's habit, he loves just to let all the press come in and begin the proceedings with a lively back and forth with the American press and the press accompanying the visiting dignitary, in this case, South Africa. Now, anybody who watched this might have been thinking, I wonder if he's going to bring up with this South African president, these images that we've been seeing, and the ongoing genocide in that country involving white farmers who are under siege by this enormously influential black South African political movement. And part of their movement is death to the farmer, and that is not an overstatement. That is exactly what their end game is. And of course,
like their platform.
Yes.
Plank one.
Exactly.
Confiscate land. Plank two, kill them.
And of course, you know, and of course, the very same people like this Senator Van Hollen. And by the way, I stand corrected. He is a senator. I check with our research team. the Senator Van Hollen, who wants to bring back all these illegal immigrants that we've deported.
Yeah, if I can interrupt for a minute, that demonstrates how liberals destroy institutions. The once great Senate, your confusion with that was because they bickered like they're in the House. But, you know, the senators, the leftist senators, destroying the dignity and the of the Senate, and he's bickering like a little, you know, a biatch, right?
I mean, if I wanted that, I could go to a school board meeting,
right?
Or something,
right.
You know?
Well, not that Levy's not there anymore, sure.
But so the South African president is in the House, and we also realize and remember very well that a little more than a week ago, 50 South African refugees were flown into the United States. These were couples with children who were identified as being in particular danger in their home country, who were brought here essentially to get them out of harm's way in South Africa. We saw that with our own eyes. So in comes the smiling South African president, and they have about 20 minutes of back and forth and pledging, you know, cooperation. And of course the South African president wants to make sure that, you know, he's on the record as being thankful to the United States for its support and whatnot, and the usual stuff. And then there's some questions back and forth with the press. And then Trump says, okay, let's change subjects. Everybody, look at the display monitor here to my right, and I'd like to show you a little something. He proceeds. he proceeds to show this now viral video of this massive political rally in which the leaders are calling for the death of South African white farmers. Killed the Boer. They chant over and over again like crazy, incessant, bloodthirsty, you know, animals, which essentially is what they are. Play clip 4.
Let me see the articles, please, if you would. And turn the lights down, and just put this on. It's right behind you, Johan.
With or without you, people are going to occupy land. We require no permission from you, from the president, from no one. We don't care. We can do whatever you want to do. Who are you to tell us whether we can occupy land or not? We are going to occupy land. Yeah. South African, occupy land. That's who we are. No, whatever you want to do, we can withdraw my membership from this useless parliament.
Honorable. Yes, Honorable. So it's never be scared to kill a revolution. Demand that at some point there must be killing, because the killing is part of the revolutionary act.
Those sounds that you're hearing are that those people trying to replicate the sounds of gunfire, essentially. They're talking about cold-blooded murder, and so you've got the South African president sitting there watching this with his fellow, the members of his delegation and the press. And what does he say after that is shown? He says, where did that come from? I haven't seen that before. He has the audacity to suggest that he's missed out on a viral video.
And to be clear, right, the person who was, and I got to say, I've heard that clip several times. It needs subtitles. And unfortunately, you can't do subtitles on the radio. But that's like the leader of a major political party there, right? I mean, that's not just like some dude in his basement. That's like a major political party chanting "Kill the Boer," right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It would be like Democrats calling for the death of the president. It would be just like that. Interesting.
Wow. Gosh.
It would be like, you know, James Comey, the former FBI director, sort of getting a kick out of some seashells that reflect a desire to remove the sitting president.
Yes.
Like that. What do you know about that?
Well,
what a coincidence.
Birds of a feather and all that.
Then, of course, Trump also had in his hand a stack of media reporting on incident after incident in South Africa of these farmers, and they're being under siege. And in some cases, you know, once they've offed these farmers, then these same terrorist home, you know, domestic terrorists in South Africa, they seize the property.
So
outright.
So we know how this is going to turn out. And the reason we know how this has turned out is, you could talk about Russia. You could talk about, Cambodia. You could talk about Cuba. You could talk about Venezuela. But you don't have to go that far. Let's talk about Rwanda genocide. Let's talk about Rhodesia. Let's talk about the Central African Republic. Country after country after country in Africa, the minute... The pattern has been the same. They take away the farmers' land, who are the white devils, right? They call them white devils. They demonize them. They take away their land. Those that don't flee, they kill. And then within a generation, that country cannot feed itself. That happened in Rhodesia. Rhodesia was the breadbasket of Africa. Rhodesia fed all their people, and they exported food around the world and all of Africa, the breadbasket of Africa. They did that. They demonized the white, imperial settlers. They took their land. They killed them. And within a generation, they weren't even able to feed their own people. There's a famine there now.
Yeah.
And that's happened in country after country after country in Africa. And all of that has been aided and abetted by white liberals who's screeching, we must get rid of imperialism. Okay, yeah. But South Africa is going to go the way of many, many, many other former successful countries in Africa.
It puts me in mind of the late great comedian Sam Kinison, who implored the folks of those countries, move where the food is. You look, live in the desert.
Look, the saying is, Africa always wins.
Yeah.
And we shall see. But look, those people who are fleeing, they are truly refugees from a regime who's trying to kill them. And by the way, at first I thought you misspoke, but you said 50. It wasn't 5 million.
No.
It wasn't 15 million illegally coming across our border. It was 50 people waving American flags, smiling, husbands, wives, entire
right.
families, not military-aged men coming across the border with questionable families. 50, and the left goes absolutely nuts. And the Episcopal Church, you remember that that clown lady who
yeah.
runs the National Cathedral?
Yeah.
Who was getting tens of millions of dollars to resell refugees. The minute one conservative refugee came across, all of a sudden they're out.
Yeah. They were absolutely beside themselves that they were white South Africans.
They literally, the Episcopal Church, and she's the head of the Episcopal Church, by the way.
The Archdiocese, yeah.
No, she's head of the Episcopal Church. Not
USA,
just,
yeah.
Yeah, of USA. So it wasn't like some rogue branch in Arkansas somewhere,
right, exactly.
Like where all the weird branches are. It was like the head of the Episcopal Church literally came out and said, I'm paraphrasing, but it's against our values to resettle white refugees, and we're out. I cannot wait for Pam Bondi, whatever
yeah.
her name
she
is.
She is blonde, but yeah.
Right, but anyway, I say that in jest. I cannot wait for the U.S. Justice Department to investigate the Episcopal Church on their self-admitted racism on government programs.
Exactly.
Like literally violating federal civil rights laws and the Constitution publicly by refusing to process white refugees. I cannot wait until she's standing trial in the Episcopal Church, to include the one here that locally that stirs up all the crap. It's, locally the Episcopal Church is the home of, it's the home of radical leftism in Moore County,
it's
the home of radical leftism throughout the entire country. And I cannot wait for them to get their just desserts.
Well, let's keep an eye on them. But the drama in the White House continued. Play clip 5.
Well, I think the videos are so... No, when you look at the videos, how does it get worse? And these are people that are officials, and they're saying that kill the white farmer and take their land. That's what it is. And I have other friends in South Africa, I have people that left, one in particular that says you can't go there. He said they want to take your land and they kill you. It's okay. And they say it's okay to do. Now, we're going to talk about it,
we're going to.
But this is a tremendous. Yeah. Look, this is a story recent. Yeah. These are all people that recently got killed.
Yeah.
And I don't know how it can get any worse. These are
people.
And you know, the man that you saw, the men that you saw, the people that you saw in that movie, those are officials. Those are people that were in office. They had one march, they had a dance in your parliament, whatever you may call it, legislature.
But let me clarify that.
Yeah,
let me clarify that, because what you saw, the speeches that were being made, one, that is not government policy. We have a multi-party democracy in South Africa that allows people to express themselves, political parties to adhere to various policies, and in many cases, or in some cases, those policies do not go along with government policy. Our government policy is completely, completely against what he was saying, even in the parliament.
Well, that may be true, but as a practical matter, tell that to the dead farmers, you know. It's that the ship has sailed and the carnage is documented. So I guess that South African president couldn't really be expected to put any different spin on it. The other thing that was interesting about the gathering in the Oval was, and I don't know who arranged this. Everybody knows, of course, that Trump is a huge golf fan, an avid golfer, and of course owns some of the finest golf resort properties in the world. Two of the gentlemen of South African descent in the room were none other than South African golfers Ernie Els and Retief Goosen. Retief actually won the Masters about 25 years ago. They're both known to Trump, obviously, as a golf fan. And I don't know if the South African president saw this coming or not, but Retief Goosen was given an opportunity to talk about the reality on the ground. Because why? He comes from a family of farmers. That is his heritage. Even though he went off to become a professional golfer, his siblings still operate the family farm. Play clip six.
It's a battle to get the water out sometimes when all the equipment gets stolen all the time that you're trying to get the water out.
So does your family and your brother, do they feel safe on the farm?
They live behind electric fences, you know, try and be at night safe. But it is constant whenever you leave that something could happen. And
there's nowhere to live.
You know, both of them has been attacked in their houses. My mom's been attacked in her house when she was 80. So it is difficult. But, you know, the guys live a great life despite everything going on.
Wow. So, I mean, you couldn't put it any more plainly than Mr. Goosen did. They live behind electric fences. My mother has been threatened. They realize that any time they leave the confines of the farm, that something could happen to them. That's the way they're living. I mean, that doesn't sound like the kind of farm life. That's not Green Acres. Let's put it that way. Yeah, exactly.
Look, I just I wonder how they kill these farmers. You know, I wonder if they used necklacing, like was the favorite weapon of Nelson Mandela in the African National Congress, where they would take suspected collaborators and they would put a tire around their arms and body, and then they would douse them in diesel fuel and set them on fire, you know. Or and by the way, Nelson Mandela's wife, Winnie Mandela, endorsed necklacing by saying, and this is a quote, "With our boxes of matches and our necklaces, that's putting tires around people and setting them on fire, we shall liberate this country." So how are they killing these farmers? Are they chopping their arms off like the genocide in Rwanda? Or are they necklacing them like Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress did?
Well, according to the stack of media reports that we saw in the White House the other day, man, there's a lot of documentation of these murders, and I guess it's going to now really come to the fore. It seems to me that maybe Jake Tapper needs to write a book about that, something that actually is, that is relevant.
No, he'll write a book just like the New York Times, just like the Granite Lady completely ignored the Nazi atrocities, right? just like they completely covered up for Hitler, Jake Trapper in 10 years will write a book and say, gosh, if we'd only known, you know, how bad it was, you know, completely ignoring the president pointed out and Elon Musk pointing this out, completely ignoring reality. He'll write a book wringing his hands. Oh, no, if only the South African government had told us the truth and not come. But they're coming forward now saying that they, you know, it's all... You cannot hate the mainstream media enough.
And I'm glad you reminded me of that, because we like to make that point weekly each reminder. And every week.
So what else do we have?
Well, so we were talking about, you know, things that are so easily ignored by the media. And again, we have another incident that I hate to have to share with you of yet another illegal immigrant being involved in the murder of an innocent American citizen. And in this case, an unborn child. A man is accused of stabbing a pregnant woman to death just recently, May the 16th, in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Hmm. Now, where is that? Rock Hill is essentially considered a southern suburb of Charlotte. So we're talking about an incident that happens right here, more or less in our region of the world. He is being held by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, because why? He's an illegal immigrant. That's why. He
illegal alien, you say?
Yes. That's,
okay, illegal alien.
He killed a 37-year-old woman.
Wait, a real woman or a transgender woman?
A real woman carrying a real baby.
Killed genuine female.
He stabbed her to death. Her unborn child did not survive, according to media reports.
Oh, so he performed an abortion.
Yes, a drive-thru. Yeah.
What's not, I mean, if you're a liberal, what's not to love? An illegal alien, not killing a transgender, but killing a real female, and an abortionist. My guess is that, the Democrats will come out and defend this South Carolina man.
So here's this guy. He's 41 years old, Pedro Mondragon Ramirez. No real other details about what he's doing here, what he does day in and day out, other than apparently stalk innocent women. But once again, this is the grim legacy of years and years of open borders. Now we've sealed off that border big time, and steps are being taken even as we speak by Tom Homan, the border czar, and the Department of Homeland Security to strengthen that border even more to the point where it will become essentially impenetrable, if I may use that wonderful word. But that doesn't stop these activist judges from claiming that we can't deport these people, that we can't round them up and ship them out of here on airplanes. You know, what we ought to really do is just load them up on the biggest airplanes we can find and get them out of here by the hundreds every day.
I don't know. I mean, don't we have we are flying these people back. Don't we have troop transport ships? Don't we have like a cruise ship, like some rusty bucket cruise ship? Don't we have barges? Why don't we just barge them back to their country?
That would be fine. It would be, you know, because that would make the environmentalists happy, because it would reduce our deportation
carbon footprint.
Yes.
Yeah. And let's just put these liberal activist judges who think they can rule by fiat. Why don't we just put them on the same barge?
I couldn't agree more. But anyway, here's another case, and you know we should really talk about this more, because I could probably cite on a weekly basis someone who is an illegal immigrant who has either committed a crime or murdered an innocent person.
Just up the road in Lee County, illegal alien kidnapped and raped a middle school girl.
And
there was like a kidnap of a
1 year old
daughter.
Yeah.
It happens. I mean, just here doing crimes that Americans won't do.
Exactly. Yeah. That's doing crimes that Americans won't do or contemplate. Well, there was a story recently. The story itself was about a year old of this woman in Denver, in the Denver suburb, who was T-boned by an SUV traveling 90 miles an hour through an intersection in July of last year, killed her on impact, or she was so her injuries were so severe that she did linger for 2 days and then ultimately died. This kid was a 15-year-old in the country, in the Denver suburbs, illegally. He was driving an uninsured car. He was then charged to the extent that he could be with vehicular homicide as a minor. Then you've got this Democrat district attorney in Arapahoe County, who was just inaugurated in January, who said that she was going to, who said on the record that her objective was more equitable outcomes when she ruled on criminal behavior. And what does she do? Just a few weeks ago, a couple of weeks ago now, she lets this kid off on probation for 2 years and community service.
Was her name Beth Tanner, Judge Beth Tanner?
No, this is the DA.
Judge Beth Tanner is our local bleeding heart.
This is a DA out in the Denver area in the suburb of Aurora.
Yeah.
And by golly, this is what the kid gets. He had to make a pledge that he would commit no further crimes and that he would stay in school.
So I am proud to report
that we
eliminated restorative justice in Moore County schools. And just FYI, just an editorial comment.
That's probably been underreported.
I have zero sympathy for the residents of Colorado, and I'll tell you why. They're getting exactly what they voted for. You know, she ran on that. They're getting exactly what they voted for. And you know what? If they find those, I just won't go to Colorado because I don't want, illegal aliens who now know they can get off scot-free crashing into people. I just don't want to get T-boned by, an illegal alien. So I avoid it. But though the citizens in Colorado are getting exactly what they voted for, and their chickens are coming home to roost, and, I will just sit back and eat my popcorn and just laugh silently.
But, can you imagine what is the thought process of saying, okay, this illegal immigrant teenager took this girl's life in the blink of an eye one fine day as she's driving home from work. By the way, she worked at a drug rehab center. Okay, that another layer of this story.
Look, liberalism is a mental disorder. I mean, those people are they're just propagandized. They're so brainwashed into this religion. She's probably Episcopal, and she sits there and listens to this Episcopal minister dressed up like a Mardi Gras clown, filling her brain full of this mush.
Well, no doubt about it. So in the time,
and then someone elected her judge, just to add to the idiocracy of it all. Or I'm sorry, elected her DA.
In the time we have remaining, let's just talk about a couple of things to keep an eye on in the week ahead, which will be, of course, a shortened week due to the Memorial Day holiday. Keep an eye on the North Carolina General Assembly. The House is moving forward with a budget, it appears. There's still a lot of sausage making to be done there. It appears that the state income tax will remain steady at 3.99%. It appears that state employees will receive a 2.5% raise. That teacher pay will be raised as it is pretty much annually. There will be some restrictions added in there. In some areas to try to reduce spending, which is sort of mirroring what's going on in Washington. The big, beautiful bill passed at 6:30 in the morning. These guys in Washington, they're like college frat boys. They have to do all they have to pull these all-nighters to do their jobs. I don't get that quite frankly. But the big, beautiful bill, which will, of course, sustain the 2017 tax cuts, which will place more requirements on those eligible for Medicaid. It will, of course, hopefully build in some spending cuts, but that remains to be seen. And in a bill this mammoth, who knows when they may be there, but they may not kick in until like 2027 or 8 or 9, and that's sometimes the little trick that they play. But I thought it would be interesting, David, because you are a businessman, and you understand quite a bit about this subject of tariffs. And of course, if we rely on the mainstream media, even the Wall Street Journal, which used to be sort of center right, every single day there's another story trying to scare people into believing that these tariffs that are being imposed by the Trump administration on all these countries who have been, you know, taking advantage of our largesse as an economic superpower for decades, that somehow this whole tariff strategy is going to implode our economy. It's going to make prices on the shelves go through the roof. It's going to punish farmers. It's going to punish manufacturers. What is your sort of general condensed view of what we can expect?
Boy, it's tough to summarize it, but tariffs are the way forward. You know, tariffs were the way the founding fathers had envisioned us, you know, funding the federal government. Up until World War I, there was no income tax. The federal government was funded largely through tariffs. And tariffs, you know, notwithstanding what the globalists have been telling us for generations, I think we're going to find out that tariffs are the road ahead. And the fact there's got to be a lot of stuff happening in conjunction with it. As you implement the tariffs, you need to do tax relief because that tariff money will replace the tax money. Trump's also negotiating, greatest of all time, President Trump is negotiating trade deals with countries. And let's look at where we are with China. You know, before Trump was president, China had like 30% tariffs across the board on all of our stuff. We had no tariffs on their stuff or very low tariffs. Now we've got 20% tariffs on their stuff and they've got 10% tariffs on ours. That's brilliant, you know? And so we're going to make trade favorable for Americans. We're going to stop these countries screwing America's. America's had trillion-dollar trade deficits for generations. You know, it just can't happen. It just can't continue. It was a house of cards. So in the long term, it's brilliant. But the Uniparty, the legacy media, they're pulling out all stops. But keep in mind, these are the same people that predicted global warming, global cooling. All, you know, we're going to run out of, remember peak oil? You know, these are the same people using the same fear tactics. And we just need to trust our President Trump and his foreign policy and his economic policy is going to be brilliant. And it's working. I can tell you from personal experience, there's a few things I import. Not a bunch, but, you know, I import some stuff in the course of business. And when Trump says other countries are going to pay for our tariffs, all the stuff I import, every single overseas manufacturer has given us a 10% price concession to make up for the tariffs because they want to be competitive in the marketplace because you still have to be competitive. So yes, Trump is right. In the case of the stuff I import, the other countries are in fact paying for the tariffs. I just saw where a foreign car manufacturer, Subaru, somebody said they were having all their stuff. I forgot it wasn't Subaru, but somebody who was importing all their stuff, 7% increase. Well, that tells me that the other countries paying 30% of the taxes. That's not a bad deal when you have other countries and companies in other countries paying our stuff. But the most important thing is it's going to revitalize industry in the United States. People, I saw the other day where people, just this morning, where people are talking about lumber, you know, putting tariffs on Canadian lumber is going to drive up the price of lumber. No, it's not. It's going to shift production to American lumber, and then all of a sudden American lumber companies are going to resurrect because they were all put out of business when NAFTA, CAFTA passed, and all of a sudden those lumber mills are going to come back up. We're going to buy American lumber, and then those lumberjacks will have jobs so they can buy houses. We're putting our economy back where it was pre-NAFTA, pre-CAFTA.
And it just takes an adult perspective on how to get that done. You know, this isn't going to happen over, you know, the left media says, well, U.S. manufacturing is not going to just come back tomorrow or next week or next year. I mean, this is going to take years. Well, so be it. Let it take years.
Right.
But if we come out the other end of this,
stronger, better,
you know, a decade from now, revitalized across the board economically, then that will be a great legacy of the Trump presidency.
Yes, sir.
And I believe that our favorite little exit song is to get our attention, yes, and to first of all remind us to thank you all very much for joining us this morning. We certainly appreciate you sharing part of your weekend with us, and we will do it again, believe it or not, next week. I am Steve Woodward. He's David Hensley. And we thank you for joining us, because we've been
taking aim.